Hi, this is Logan Ipp from the Harvard Lacrosse team, and you are listening to the D-Fly and Dixie podcast.
Welcome back to the D-Fly and Dixie podcast, brought to you by our presenting partner, Simplicity Group. Featuring Big Ten Network, ESPN, and Inside Lacrosse analyst, and my old Blue Jay brother, Mark Dixon. I am your host, Dan Flynn. Dix, great show on tap. Again, we'll talk to Harvard star midfielder Logan Ipp as the Crimson prep for the Ivy opener this week at Penn. And we'll be joined later by Ray Carnicelli, our guest analyst this week, as we preview the nation's biggest games. So, Dix, let's get it. Dixie, we have been treated to a schedule and slate of games the last several weeks that are just almost unparalleled. I think we had 8 games last weekend. Before that, there was 6. This one is a little light. It's light. In the arc of the season, only 2 top 20 games this week as we sort of fall between those like big-time non-conference games and some teams that haven't jumped into their full conference schedule. It's a little light, but there's still some really interesting lacrosse to talk about, and we're going to get to that. But how are you doing this week, Dix?
I'm okay. I've been a little bit under the weather. I get these weird things that just hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, I'll go to bed feeling fine, and then I won't sleep well, and then I'm just like, oh, I just didn't get a good night of sleep. And then I get out of bed, and it's like I'm standing on linguine, and my head just feels like, I don't know. And then it morphs into a GI issue. So I'm on the tail end of it. It started yesterday morning. Now I'm on the tail end. But what gives me GI distress is you're so spoiled with the schedule of look. I mean, we still got great games this weekend.
We do have some really great games.
I need to remind you of the 2020 season with the and the 21 season with COVID when it was taken away from us.
You don't. But thank you for doing that. Again, we haven't spoiled. But, only 2 top 20 games. Still 2 top 20 games.
Yeah, but these games are still really interesting, damn good. But I hear what you're saying. I'm going to go in a different direction to complain. And I thought when you said we've been treated to, I thought you're going to say outstanding weather.
Oh, my God. It's 83 degrees today.
The weather has been fantastic.
83.
But we're going to experience a big shift. We're recording this on Wednesday night. And as we speak, the bells just went off on our phones about tornado, wind, rain, all that kind of stuff. So literally, I think it reached 85 degrees today in Baltimore. It's going to drop 30 degrees. And then I don't want to kill your St. Patrick's Day, but I looked ahead to next week.
Yeah.
St. Patrick's Day Tuesday is supposed to be 38 degrees.
That's okay.
It's not.
Inside drinking my pint and eating my corned beef. Doesn't matter to me.
Loyola plays Georgetown next Tuesday.
Oh, that's right. That's a makeup game. That is, yeah.
Rescheduled.
That is unfortunate. You know, my wife and daughter are out at Western Regional Park right now for 7:30 lacrosse practice.
That ain't going to happen.
And the tornado.
Those daggone. I mean, listen, God bless the technology of lightning detectors, but when it has a 15-mile radius, that's a little much. But I digress.
Now, I'm looking over at our guest this week. I'm going to invite Ray Carnicelli in right now to join us. Ray is the play-by-play announcer for the Jacksonville Dolphins and Flagler College lacrosse team, longtime friend of the pod. Ray, welcome to the D-Fly and Dixie podcast.
Glad to be here. I've been listening for years, and my time to be on the show. I'm very excited about it.
So, Ray, you went to SUNY Cortland. How did you end up down in Jacksonville, you know, doing your day job? And then how did you get involved with the Jacksonville lacrosse scene as like in-depth as you are, known as Mr. Lax 904?
Yeah, so I graduated in 1990, and I had a friend. I went to junior college and played for a year at SUNY Canton. It was Canton ATC at the time up in northern New York. And he had moved down to Florida a year before. So when I finished up at Cortland after my senior season, didn't have a lot going on in upstate New York at the time. And so I packed up my car. I'd never been to Florida before and crashed on his couch, got hired with a company that I still work with here 35 years later. And so that's how I made it to Florida. And I hooked up with the Jacksonville Armadillos. And it's interesting, back in those days, younger people don't remember, we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have the internet. And so I opened up my oversized lacrosse magazine, and I called in Baltimore, I called U.S. Lacrosse. I said, are there any teams in Florida? They put me up in touch with the team in the chapter in Orlando. They put me in touch with the team in the chapter in Jacksonville, all by phone call. So when I got here, I had a contact in the lacrosse community, because I just finished my senior year, started for Cortland, played with some really great players back then, back when we were still playing D1 schools at the time. So I had a lot of gas left in the tank, and I wanted to play, and hooked up with the Jacksonville Armadillo team with some Navy legends. I mentioned it on the broadcast last night. Mike Buzzle was around, and Joe Avaduti. These Navy legends were stationed here in Jacksonville. So I immediately fell into this great lacrosse community here in the Jacksonville area.
Did you run the Armadillo with the Jacksonville Armadillos?
Not while my time there. They probably did. That team was founded, believe it or not, in the early 70s by these Navy guys. I showed up in 1990, in the fall of 90. So no, we did not run the Armadillo.
So how have you seen, I mean, I watched broadcast last night, and I can see the growth of the program, especially under Coach Galloway at Jacksonville University. But like, how can you describe and characterize like that growth of the sport, not just at the college level, but even across the board in Northern Florida?
Yeah. So when I got here in 1990, it was just the Armadillos. Then there were a couple of Navy guys who started some high school club programs. I, along with some other transplants, started a youth program here in Ponte Vedra Beach, where I lived, when my boys were, let's see, they were in fourth and third grade, and now they're one as a child, they're 31 and 30, my two oldest. So that's how long ago we started the youth program. There was one goal, one set of goals where the Navy guys practiced. So we got the youth program going, then the high schools picked up throughout Florida. And then in 2009, I got a call from some guy named Matt Kerwick, who told me, we heard that Jacksonville was getting a Division I team, and I didn't believe it, because we used to play their club program. I was like, there's no way they're going to have Division I men's lacrosse. And he asked me if I wanted to be on the staff, and so I was a volunteer assistant in season number one in 2010, and then started calling the games in 2011. So it's just been overwhelming. Some of the players that we've had here, like Dylan Hass, like Carter Parlett, I'll leave some guys off. I know like Jack Pelote, the starting goalie at Penn this year. There's just been so many players. You could put an all-star team together of the players just from our Jacksonville area who have had great Division I college careers. And that was incomprehensible back in the 90s, even in the early 2000s.
So let's jump right into the game previews then. A reminder that the D-Fly and Dixie podcast is brought to you by our presenting partner, Simplicity Group. Simplicity Group is a leading financial products distribution firm, specializes in providing best-in-class insurance, investment, and business development solutions. To learn more, visit simplicitygroup.com. All right, first game up. All these games are taking place on Saturday. This first one is at noon, and it features the number 14 Army Black Knights, who are 6-1. They're 1-1 in the Patriot League after their loss last week. They'll play at number 21 ranked Boston University, 4-2. They're 2-0 in the Patriot League. This game is at noon. Fans can catch it on ESPN Plus. And Army is a 1.5-point favorite in this game. Dixie, I'll let you start off.
So a surprising result from last weekend, Army losing to Lafayette. Huge win for the Leopards. And when you look at this Army team, they lost so much from a year ago. Mainly an off-the-field loss was Justin Ward, now the offensive coordinator at Loyola. But the offense is still playing pretty good lacrosse. The biggest difference I see is at the faceoff dot, where Army is just south of 50%, right around 48, 49%. BU coming in right around 54%. Will that make a difference? We can wait and see. Sean Byrne, the goalie for Army, still saving around 60, 62%. But, you know, this game has star power. when you look at it in the Patriot League. Timmy Shanahan for BU and the Terriers. And then you have Evan and Hill Plunkett. And I say both of them just because Evan was really the known commodity coming into 2026, but his younger brother Hill has been fantastic so far. And to me, this is a battle of the two programs that have really, with all due respect to Colgate and Lehigh, who won the last two Patriot League tournaments, consistently Army and BU have been that upper echelon in terms of out-of-conference performance and then seeding themselves well. They haven't been able to really pull it through as much as they would have liked. And two, just not only the best coaches in the Patriot League, but in the country. You know, Army's Joe Alberisi and BU's Ryan Pulley. So I think this is going to be a terrific game. It's going to be like, I think it's going to be the winner's got to get around the 12, I think. I'm thinking about a 12-11, 12-10 kind of game. And BU's just it's a neat stadium with a lot of history, but it's also weird. Like it sits right off of a highway, overlooked by student housing. And then you got the cool ivy in the one end zone. And then the bleachers just kind of go straight up. It's just a very unique setting and not the most friendliest for teams visiting. So I expect a good game between these two. BU's on a two-game win streak and Army, again, looking to right the ship.
Yeah, I had a chance to call the Army game against Michigan, the Atlanta Lacrosse Classic, and it was just such an amazing game. Coach Alberisi was my high school teammate at Auburn High. He was a year behind me. I was 86. He was 87. So I've known his family forever. But that team, Gunnar Fellows is a player I just love to watch off ball. Every young attackman or midi should just watch the way he moves off ball. BU with that 10-man ride and the pressure they bring, I think Army's going to be able to clear the ball, which is important. Obviously, the drop-off at the face-off's going to be, you know, they've been dealing with that all year. But as Mark said, burn and goal kind of makes up for that a little bit. So, I feel like, you know, Army's going to have a nice rebound.
Yeah, I like the Army Black Knights in this one, too, to win this game. Would you agree, Ray?
Yes. Yes.
All right. A team that you just saw play just the other night, Ray, the Navy Midshipmen, they're 4-2 now. They will take on the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays, who are also 4-2, at 1 o'clock, Allen Homewood Field in Baltimore. This game is live on ESPN+. You can see it's on ESPNU, tape delayed on Sunday. And the Blue Jays are 2.5 goal favorites in this one. This is a series where Hopkins and Navy have split the last four meetings, with the visiting team winning on the opponent's home field each of the last 4 years. Ray, I'll let you talk about this one in a game, Navy, you just covered just the other night.
Yeah, this Hopkins team is tough. I think they're the real deal. I think they're going to compete in the Big Ten. Navy has this extra gear, though. We saw it in the second half against Bucknell. I mean, they battled against BU, but they got in a hole. But it started with that second to third quarter against Bucknell, where they went on this 10-goal run. And yet, the game I called against here in Jacksonville, you know, they got down 2-0. It looked like Jacksonville early on was going to, had their foot on the gas. And Navy just found this way to find the right gear and battle hard and come back. They never had the body language like they were down and out, like you would expect from this Navy team. They had some guys who were under the weather, so they were a little shorthanded on defense. But the defense and the goalie play, they've got two great face-off guys as well, and that wears down a team. They were able to alternate every couple of face-offs, so they go about 50-50 on the face-off. So I feel like Navy is going to be able to play 60 minutes of strong lacrosse. So I'm going with the other service academy, Navy.
Remember a time where Hopkins won, I want to say, 20 years in a row against Navy? Those days are in the past. I was able to watch that game last night, Ray. You and Garrett Lubker did a great job, and I watched it until halftime, and then I turned it back on late when it was tied. Jacksonville was in a timeout. They scored to tie it. I'm sorry, to go up by one, and then Mac Haley just put his big boy pants on and made a nice play, and then Navy was able to win it in overtime. We talk about Penn State being a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde all over the place. Navy fits that bill to a certain extent. Some head-scratching losses and some terrific wins. But to your point, they found a way to grit one out in Jacksonville on the road, down a few key players. That's a tough environment. I've been down there. Those folks that sit along the sideline on the Adirondack chairs let you know that they're there. And then you look at Johns Hopkins, a team that had that emotional come-from-behind victory against Virginia, and then they have Syracuse on their home field, and they shoot 8-for-50. And then McCool from Syracuse, when I say only, I mean, he made 12 saves. He played a really good game, but only made 12 saves. You know, that means that, you know, 30 of your shots aren't even reaching the frame. So you got to calibrate that if you're Hopkins. And I watched a good part of that game, was doing the old quad box in my hotel room in Charlottesville last weekend. Got to take better shots. Matt Collison at times seemed, is Matt Collison disinterested, or is he just underutilized? That's the big question I ask with the Hopkins offense. And let's not forget, Peter Millen was the coach of Cornell when Jeff Teat was there. And you remember when teams used to shut off Jeff Teat, and he would just allow himself to be shut off. He wasn't working to get the ball. They wouldn't incorporate Teat into the offense. Are we seeing that 2.0 with Matt Collison? I'm not saying Collison is should get the ball every single possession, this, that, and the other thing, but when you got a middy that size and everybody's talking about him being such a force and potential top five pick in the PLL draft in a few months, don't you think you want him a little bit more involved in the offense versus being cute with all the passing and the this, that, and the other thing? So I'm looking at Collison getting a little bit more involved. Oren Gelinas seems to have solidified the goalie position. He had another nice game against Syracuse, following up in the effort against Virginia. This is a huge game for Johns Hopkins, because all of a sudden what looked like an epic win against Virginia has lost a little bit of luster with the Cavaliers' performance last weekend against Towson. So they could use this win, especially if Navy is, you know, we talk about it all the time. These wins that you bank are like buying stock, and you hope they just pay off in the future. And you know, if Hopkins can beat the Squids, they're going to be hoping that they can have a nice run in the Patriot League.
Ray, you took the Naval Academy. I'm going to go the other way and take the Blue Jays on Homewood Field. They're 2.5 goal favorites. I'll stick with my Jays. But I do think it's going to be close. I think it's going to be a really close game, a one-goal game. All right, moving on. One of the biggest games of the weekend is the Ivy opener for Harvard and Penn in Philadelphia. Before we get to that game, let's bring in our guest this week, Logan Ipp from Harvard. Please welcome into the show first-team All-Ivy midfielder and All-American and captain of the Harvard Crimson, Logan Ipp. Logan, thank you for joining us on the D-Fly and Dixie podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Logan, you and your team had a great fall season. How did you guys carry that over from the fall through the winter and into your perfect 5-0 start to start the season?
Yeah, I think I credit a lot of it really to our preparation starting in the fall. I think that we have a lot of trust in one another and belief in our goals. And I think that really allows us to execute efficiently and unselfishly when it comes to the game. And I really think that everyone on this team is very bought in, and they understand how important their role is on this team to the success of the team. And particularly, I think the scout guys. Right? I think the scout guys have done an amazing job doing their job, really being the players that they are week, and I think that just really helps us to be prepared when it comes to the game. And I think that first thing that comes to my mind are guys like Michael Smythe, Blake Hetherington, Mac Moan, Tyler Menino, and the entire scout team, who've just done an amazing job of stepping up and really embodying their guys throughout the week. And I also think that I credit it to the leadership of our team. I think particularly the upperclassmen. You know, in our entire class, we went 5-7 my freshman year, and we were just pretty upset about that. And that wasn't just a good representation of who we were. And so I think after that year, we came together and we wanted to do everything in our power to be a winning program. And so I think that our upper class is extremely tight. We all share a belief that we can accomplish our goals. And I think that last year we saw some success making it to the tournament, making it the Ivy League tournament for the first time in my career. And I think that we were happy, but we weren't satisfied with just making it. And so I think at the beginning of this year, we created a set of upperclassmen standards that we hold ourselves to accountable of as well as each other. I think that those standards have really trickled down throughout the entire team, and that's definitely helped to lead us to this successful start so far.
Talk about team leadership. You were selected a team captain for the second year in a row. You're a tri captain with two other classmates. You're just the 17th multi-year captain in the nearly 150-year history of Harvard. What does that say about the trust and respect that your teammates give to you? And what does that responsibility that they invest in you mean to you personally?
Yeah, I think it's a true honor. I think it's a true honor being selected by my teammates in order to represent this group. Jack Spidell and Sean Jordan, we all share this common idea that being a captain is just a title. And I think that that title may allow you to lead in certain ways, but at the end of the day, you're a team. And I think our team in particular, we really promote and value leadership no matter the position or class. And so I think that although that I am the captain in title, I think we have amazing leaders throughout the entire team. And I think that this idea of democratic accountability has spread throughout the entire team as well as to different classes. And so I think that throughout the fall and throughout the spring in our practices, we have freshmen calling out seniors, sophomores calling out juniors. And I think that level of accountability throughout the team, where everyone's able to be a leader and others are able to be followers, has really allowed us to see success. And I think that is really special about our overall team culture and leadership.
Jordan Field has become one of the more tougher places to play nationally. What makes the game day environment so special there?
Yeah, Jordan Field is definitely a very special place in my heart. And I think that the fans really just make the experience. I think that we have an amazing and very supportive community in the Boston and Cambridge area. And I think that there's these really close interactions with the fans and the players that make Jordan Field so special. If you watch on TV, there's not that many stands at Jordan Field. You have about one set of bleachers. But what you really see is you see all these fans lining up and standing on each end line. They're standing by the bleachers. And I think it makes it feel really packed. And I think the fans do an amazing job no matter the weather, like you saw against Syracuse. It was 32 and sleeting. Or if it's a beautiful day in Cambridge, I think the fans always show up no matter the weather of the opponent. And I think that kind of what leads to it is the relationship that we have with the community. I think that Harvard does an amazing job of volunteering and giving back to the community. We help to volunteer with Harlan Lacrosse, and we have youth teams come to our practices. They come to our field and play catch with us. We get to create these bonds and real relationships with the community. So I think those relationships help to foster an amazing environment on Saturdays or Tuesdays and Fridays for our games.
So Sam King was a huge part of your program for the last 4 years, an incredible offensive player. How has your offense adjusted to life without Sam King?
Yeah, I think Sam was an amazing player, and I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to play with him. But I think this year we've had a lot more of a democratic style of offense. I think if you look at the production levels, it's pretty even throughout. I think a lot of our goals come assisted. I think that Teddy Malone, Jack Spidell, and Ethan Cody have done an amazing job of stepping up into a role where they're able to just play their own game. And I think we play a really unselfish, simple style of offense. Amazing job of stepping up into a large role, being able to beat a short stick, beat his matchup, draw a great slide. And he's been doing a really good job of making decisions after that slide. Guys like Andrew Perry has been a staple for this program for the past 4 years. And then you have other guys like Jackson Green, Jack Peterson, Jared Masnick, Logan Turley, Oscar Wilson, who have all done an amazing job. And I think something about our offense that is special is we play with high energy. and we just play unselfish. I think before each game, we always tell each other just to play our game. And each defense might try to switch things up, or they might try to throw a curveball at us. But at the end of the day, we just have to play lacrosse, trust one another, and play our game. And so far, it's worked out so well.
In your 5-0 start, the offense has been exceptional. Some people say that you may have the best midfield in the country, but your defense is also getting the job done. Who are some of the stars on the defensive side of the field for the Crimson that our listeners need to know about?
Yeah, I think our defense is a very special group. I think, you know, this past summer and offseason, we got a new defensive coordinator. Coach Andy Myers has done an amazing job. But I think the players have also really bought into the defensive mindset of playing as a team. You have guys like Sean Jordan, who has been an amazing leader, who really sets the tone in practice throughout the games. Guys like Yost Koning has stepped up for us, not only in a leadership role, but also on the field as one of our top cover guys. You have Michael Sabato battling an ankle injury, coming back so quickly and making a real impact. Quinn Kelly coming back coming as a freshman and really making a large impact. Wyatt Wiggins doing his thing on the wing, picking up a lot of ground balls. Charlie Muller is also doing a great job of organizing and communicating on the defensive end. And I really think our D middies have done an amazing job. I think, you know, they could arguably be the best defensive midfield in the country, of guys like Owen Guest, Finn Jensen, Finn Picorni, and Callum McLaughlin, who all step up in their own ways, not only on the defensive end, guarding and picking up tough ground balls, but also running transition, which is a big part of our game. And I really think just the continuity of our defense, having a lot of senior leadership and then, you know, freshmen and sophomores coming in and stepping up in a large role, they're all bought in to play as a team and play team defense, which I think makes our defensive side of the ball so special and so good for us.
Yeah, switching gears a little bit, in 2023, you played on the Hong Kong national team, and you were outstanding on it. With the Olympics coming up in 2028, have you given any thought to international play, and what are some of your goals and intentions there?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would love the opportunity, if it came my way, to play in the Olympics. I know that it's in LA, which is close to me and close to home, so I would definitely have a lot of family members coming to support. But I think that I would love the opportunity to play. I think that sixes format suits my game very well. I think that I see myself as someone who can play defense, can play offense, can run transition. So I think the fast-paced nature of the game is something that, if I was given the opportunity, I would love to participate in, whether with Hong Kong or the United States. And I know that I would love that opportunity.
This weekend, the Crimson are going down to Philadelphia to take on the Penn Quakers, who are in the top 20 this week. What does Harvard need to do to get their first Ivy League win against the Quakers?
Yeah, Penn's always a really good lacrosse program. They're obviously have a new coach. They play with high energy and a high compete level. But I think the keys to our success at least always come from within. I think that we focus on ourselves, play on selfish offense, play on an efficient level, take good shots, you know, fight for hard ground balls and ride hard. I think those are all staples of playing Harvard lacrosse. And I think the other thing is just to focus on the little things. There's a lot of plays in the game that may not be recognized on television or on the highlights on YouTube, but in the locker room, we definitely recognize those plays. And so I think focusing on those little plays and having those add up throughout the game are large keys for our success if we want to win on Saturday.
Great. Ready for some quick hitters?
Let's do it.
All right, Logan, what's your all-time favorite sports team?
The Los Angeles Lakers.
What are your prospects for the Lakers this season?
I think LeBron's aging, but I think Luka Doncic has done a pretty good job of leading the team. But I think we definitely need to work on some of our defense and defensive efficiency. But I still got hope in our team.
All right. What is the best Harvard lacrosse tradition?
I'd have to go with the Burrito Bowl. It's a fall scrimmage that we have every year, and we invite Team Impact, which is an organization that partners college across or college programs with kids that have medical disabilities or medical procedures. And we invite a bunch of kids out. Winners get burritos, losers get salads. So it's always a fun event.
Why do you wear number 3?
Yeah, so I was actually 53 my freshman year. Yeah. That was a number that I didn't really get to choose, but it was kind of one of the only ones that were available. And so going into my sophomore year, I was debating whether I wanted to stick with 53, but 3 was actually available. Our senior captain graduated, and I decided to take that number.
Yeah, you look much better as just 3 than 53. We talk about food a lot on this podcast, so I'm going to ask you food questions. Your family comes into town for a game, or you're going out afterwards to celebrate. Who's got the best food in Cambridge? Where are you going?
That's a great question. I think if you're going for a quick bite, you can never go wrong with Felipe's. That's where we always get our burritos for the burrito bowl, super burrito, carnitas, Mexican rice, black beans, always the way to go. But if I'm going to go for a sit-down spot in Harvard Square, Hourly Oyster Bar is definitely the place that I love to take my parents.
Nice. Size the men's lacrosse team. Which Harvard Crimson team would you say you have the most friends on?
I got to go with Harvard Men's Hockey. We're actually roommates with them. They're a great group of guys, and they actually play Cornell this weekend in the playoffs. So we'll be cheering them on from afar.
Nice. All right, you are from Newport Coast, native of Southern California. What's the best piece of advice someone has given you or that you've learned to deal with Boston winters?
I think the first thing is probably not come to school with 4 pairs of pants. So definitely buy some sweatpants and have some pants in your closet. And then the winter snow boots are definitely key, especially this year with the large winter storms that have been coming in. I'm glad that I have a pair of winter snow boots because those definitely come in handy.
Who's the best cook or chef on the Harvard lacrosse team?
Oh, that's a great question. I got to go with Francisco Cortez. He's got a Instagram food account that he critiques food, and he's also great on the grill. So got to go with Franny.
What are his specialties? Is he, you know?
He has a great steak and dining hall. He can always whip up whatever, something great with whatever they have.
So we asked some of the same questions to players, and there seems like there's one, at least one guy on every team who is like the food guy who has an Instagram account. I got to start keeping track of them and share them with our listeners because I think people want to hear this. All right. What is your, you're going on the road this week, play down in Philadelphia. What's your favorite road venue to play in the Ivy League?
Yeah, I'd say either Franklin Field or cool environment with that old stadium. And then I always love going into Yale and playing at their place. I think it's always a fun little rivalry.
All right, final question. If Dixie or I walk into the Crimson locker room, two-part question, who is running the aux and what are we going to hear blasting in the locker room?
Ooh, that's a great question. We got a lot of guys on aux, but I'd say if Teddy Malone's on aux, you got some Zach Brown. And then if you got Jack Weisenberger, you probably have an EDM DJ mix going. But it's definitely a wide variety. Teddy Malone's got Olivia Dean bumping in the locker room as well recently.
Hey, Logan, thanks for joining us on the D-Fly and Dixie podcast. Best of luck to you and your Crimson teammates throughout the season.
Great. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
This was a great opportunity to speak to Logan and hear more about the Harvard Crimson program. They've got a great thing going up there in Boston. They will go down to Philadelphia, though, this week. And the number 4 ranked Harvard Crimson, they're 5-0, undefeated, will play their Ivy League opener at Penn. Penn is a tough team. They're 3-3. They've played a really good schedule. This game's at 1 o'clock. Fans can catch it on ESPN+. Plus. Harvard is a 2.5 goal favorite. Dixie, I'll let you start the analysis of this game.
Thank goodness the game is during the day at Franklin Field. Logan Ipp really is the catalyst of this Harvard offense. When you look at their numbers, Spidell, Cobery, Arant, Teddy Malone, you know, Andrew Perry, those are guys who have points, but Ipp is the party starter. He's electric. Being able to cover him last year was a real pleasure. Funny thing is, Harvard's better at the face-off. They faced off last year around, 33-35%. They're now around 48%. So they're not great at the face-off, but that's an extra 2-3 possessions a game. And that's really helped this offense, which I think is really, really good. And, you know, you talked about it with Logan. How do you replace a guy like Sam King? You really don't. You just have other guys need to play bigger roles and step up and be a part of things. You hit the nail on the head with Penn. They're a very, very tough, physical lacrosse team. They've adopted the personality of their head coach, Taylor Ray. I know all of us, I think we were too young to really get into it, but you know, the old Philadelphia Flyers, the Broad Street Bullies, I look at Penn lacrosse, that's them. They spend a lot of time in the penalty box. They play an incredibly physical brand of lacrosse, but they also have some really nice skill players. And one player that I was really impressed with, I got to see in person a few weeks ago, was Griffin Skain. Terrific finisher, very smooth. So this will be a knockdown. You know, Penn's going to want Harvard in this game are the pretty boys, and Penn are not. And Penn's going to want to make this game ugly. Can Harvard play ugly if it goes that way? Because if Penn gets the game in that situation, it could be tough.
You mentioned the Broad Street Bullies and the Dave Schultz and those guys, and I agree with Penn. I love defense. You know, everyone wants the 18 to 20 goal games. I love 9-7 or 8-5. And the way that Penn defense plays, and I mentioned Jack Pelot earlier, I was wondering if he was going to get a chance in goal when he got to Penn, because they're always so deep at goal. And he's saving in the mid 50. I think he's at 56-57%. Small, low goals against average. Boy, they almost pulled it out against Syracuse. And I think that Penn defense is just, they're gonna try to push them around. And I think Penn's gonna come out on top on this one. It's gonna be a game that, we talked about, hinting at maybe it was a weaker week of lacrosse. But this game is as good as I've seen in a while on paper. Wanting to watch this one, and the conference play is so much fun. It just, everything's elevated. I always refer to the non-conference games as the cotton candy. Well, this is the main course, and I'm looking forward to the conference play and taking Penn.
Ray, I'm looking at you right now. There's no way you're telling me you eat cotton candy.
I eat everything, Mark.
Okay. I was going to say, cotton candy, come on, man.
Ray is anytime. He's very fit. And it looks great.
And I am not.
This is going to tell us a lot about Harvard. I think we really know who Penn is. They are going to mix it up. They're going to fight on their home field, especially. We're going to learn a lot about Harvard, but I think they have enough in the tank to get their first Ivy League win, and I'm going to take Harvard in this one.
Can't wait to watch.
All right, moving on. When the calendar comes out or the schedules come out like late in the fall, you might have circled this one. And I remember Dixie and I talking about this game a few years ago. It was at the Audi Stadium, where the DC soccer team plays, and Virginia is going to play at number 10 Maryland at 1 o'clock this weekend. And it's not the matchup that lacrosse fans may have thought, but this game means a lot to these two teams, and both of these teams really need this W. Virginia's 3-3, Maryland is 2-3. Fans can catch this on the Big Ten Network. The Terps are 3.5 goal favorites. And Ray, I'll let you kick off this one.
Virginia looks broken, not just with the big letdown, but they just look disorganized. I don't see any hope for Virginia this season in the ACC. I think Maryland has shown flashes where they could get back to what everyone expects of Maryland, but Virginia just looks like dysfunction. And no criticism to the players, but the body language during that collapse in the last game, it just looks like some of the senior leaders have to step up and try to pull that team together before it goes completely off the rails. But I don't think it's going to be this week.
So I'll have this game with Joe Beninati on Big Ten Network. And I witnessed firsthand calling the Towson, Virginia game with Paul Carcaterra last week, Ray, what you're talking about. And, it just wasn't Virginia lacrosse to me. It was offensively, they didn't get the ball a whole lot, mainly because Towson was scoring so proficiently. The Virginia defense, even with John Schroeder back in the lineup, I thought that was going to be a huge difference for those guys, and it just wasn't. Their off-ball defense leaves a lot to be desired. Towson was able to find a lot of seams. We had a lot of fun on the broadcast with Alex Roussel. The Rooster is his nickname, and he went off. I think he had 4 goals and 5 assists. He had 9 points and was outstanding. You know, Virginia right now needs to find a way to limit people from getting slam dunks on their goaltender, which last week was Jake Marek, the transfer from Air Force. And Virginia just had a lot of selfish plays and penalties in that game. And they got to really cut down on that, because the one team, I mean, you can't afford to do that against any Division I team. But if any team is going to take advantage of that kind of thing, is Maryland, especially at home. And it's funny. Maryland sits at 1-3. John Tillman hadn't lost 3 games in a row since the Clinton administration, apparently. And when you look at their win against Delaware, people are like, eh, that I'm not impressed. I still think Maryland stinks. They're still trying to figure it out. They're still coming together as a team. Leo Johnson leads the way in scoring, and Chris Lyons is their third leading scorer. So 2 transfers are leading the way offensively. Will Eric Spanos play in this game? He's missed the last 2 contests. He's wearing number 1. He's a huge part of this team. And it's kind of funny to talk about Maryland and defense, but they've been disorganized defensively this season, something very uncharacteristic. But, you know, Maryland always, you know, we had Will Schaller on the show a couple weeks ago, talked about how you go from just kind of a third wheel to the main guy. In between there every year, you always have a linchpin inside. And for the last couple of years, that was Colin Burlace. And now he's gone. So you've got Peter Lake, a sophomore. You've got Mikey Alexander, a transfer. And then you got Will Schaller, who's your number 1 cover guy. I think they're still developing that traffic cop inside that can, you know, that can really control things in the middle. So you guys said it. This is a big game for both these ball clubs, probably a little bit bigger for Virginia based on their recent performance. But and Dan, to your point, when the schedule first came out for Big Ten Network, this game was not on. And I heard, I tell you, I over the last month, well, I make it 6 weeks because it probably hit the schedule about a month ago. Over the last 6 weeks, I got the biggest gripes for 2 things. 1, leaving Tawnytown in Catonsville off of my best deli sandwich rundown last weekend from all the people in a 228. And then 2, people bitching that Virginia Maryland was only going to be on Big Ten Network Plus. Well, guess what? It's on linear. You better watch. We'll have it. And I'm excited for it.
All right. That game will be at 1 o'clock on Big Ten Network with Dixie on the call. I think the Terps win this one, and they've won 5 of the last 6 in this series, and they're going to make it 6 out of 7. Ray, your thoughts?
Agreed. Maryland.
All right. Our final game of the weekend that we'll preview is a really good one, a legit top 10 matchup. Number 5, North Carolina, who's 6-1, will take on number 9, Penn State, 4-2. This game is in the Crown Lacrosse Classic in Charlotte, North Carolina. It'll take place at 6:30 at night.
Great game on tap in Charlotte. The folks in North Carolina are in for a treat. 2 heavyweights in the sport. It starts at the face-off dot. Brady Wambach of Carolina, Reed Gills of Penn State, both facing off over 70%. You've got deep midfields. You've got stellar attack. You've got athletic defenses. And 2 freshman goalies. And Josh Marcus and Preston Hawkins. So Carolina's been a little bit more consistent, but how about Penn State last weekend beating Cornell 19-7 in Panzer? Hunter Aquino did not play. And this is the 2nd year in a row where Penn State played Cornell. Remember a year ago, they played him up in Ithaca and their entire starting attack unit was out and they still beat Cornell. I think there's a huge emotional component that goes along with Penn State playing Cornell for a lot of reasons. This is a huge test for both ball clubs. I'm looking forward to it. I think tempo will be key in this one. Carolina loves to push the pace. Not that Penn State doesn't, but Penn State prefers the 6-on-6 setting. Carolina would like to beat you in between the lines, and they've got maybe the best duo in short stick D middies and Leif Hagerup and Ty English. But again, it all starts at the face-off dot. You're looking at potentially your first and second team All-Americans facing off in early March against one another.
Ray, your thoughts?
I'm gonna go with North Carolina in this game. I think that offense, obviously Penn State's is as well, but I think the North Carolina offense is ready to reach the next level here with a few games under their belt. That depth, the breadth of scoring potential from that strong attack in the midfield as well. And I had a chance to go to that Crown Classic a couple of times. Saw Penn State play there before against Jacksonville. It's a great setup, a great event. And I think North Carolina playing in the home state, I think they're going to come out on top in this one.
I agree with you. I'm going to take the Tar Heels too. Find your favorite game, your favorite team, and make your plans to watch. All right, guys, it's time for our give and go. And this is a rare occasion. I think Dixie is leading the charge on the give and go. So, Dixie, I'll turn it over to you for this one.
I appreciate you taking my recommendation. So we have and I don't know if he's been listening for a couple years, and he just came out publicly with this, my roommate from college, Steve McCardle, football player from Garden City.
He was a closeted D-Fly and Dixie fan.
Yeah.
And he's out now.
He's like, hey, I love how you talk about this and I love how you talk about that. And I'm like, oh, wow. And so we've been going back and forth. Steve is a huge Giants fan. I am a Ravens fan. And what happened with Max Crosby with the Ravens, and not only that, there's a number of Ravens as free agents that are going to the New York Giants. He said something, we were texting back and forth. He goes, hey, you guys should talk about the NFL free agency on your podcast. I'm like, that's a pretty good idea. So I guess the topic for today will be best, worst trades in NFL history and best, worst free agency signings in NFL. And, when I say NFL history, to our knowledge, who wants to start?
I'll start. We'll first address the Max Crosby thing.
Yeah.
Right. So, I actually thought it was actually a good move by the Ravens. Obviously he is a fantastic player. The Ravens, that is maybe the weakest part of their football team, was their inability to rush the passer for several seasons, not just this year. I think our defensive backfield is really strong with guys like Kyle Hamilton, our cornerbacks, Malachi Starks at safety with Hamilton. But we can't get any rush on anybody. So that was the biggest glaring thing that we needed, and we filled that. I didn't love giving up the 2 first-round picks, but the other thing the Ravens really needed was offensive line help. And I feel like the Ravens have success in history of being able to, in that second, third, fourth round, get quality offensive linemen. And I felt like there was value there, and they know what they're doing, and I trust them. So I was all for it. But if he failed his physical and couldn't play, and we're getting those 2 first-round picks back, and Trey Henderson. I'm actually happy with this too. So, disappointed, but I understand it. Again, I have Eric DaCosta in that Ravens front office has bought a lot of trust and goodwill from this particular Ravens fan over the years, and I will defer to that, and we'll move on. I don't like that we missed out on a lot of the opportunity on a lot of other players, though, and that's where it really hurts.
I think the other thing, so you look at all these items coming out on social media, it reminded me that Tom Brady is now part of the Raiders brain trust. So, and a narrative was established that the Raiders duped the Ravens trading Max Crosby so they wouldn't have the cap space to re-sign Tyler Lindenbaum, the center, who is now a Raider. I'm not sure how much water that holds. But this whole thing is the day went on today. It's like, okay, the Ravens are SOBs for doing this. Now it's, or I'm sorry, the Raiders are SOBs. Now it's like the Ravens are the villains. And let's keep in mind too, the franchise is only 30 years old, but I believe it's the first time in franchise history that they traded first round draft picks. I don't think prior to this they ever traded any first round draft picks. So that was historical. My basic primitive interpretation of this is Ozzie Newsome got a hold of Eric DaCosta and slapped the paste out of his mouth and said, what are you doing? And they reversed course. So
that may have happened. That may have happened.
So go ahead.
Ray, who's your team? Are you a Jacksonville fan?
Yeah, I'm a Jacksonville fan since the beginning. In terms of like my favorite trade of all time, and it was just for sheer entertainment value, was Ricky Williams to the Saints. And between Ditka just going home after all the trades in that draft and all the the dysfunction that came along with it, for sheer entertainment value, best trade of all time. Mark Brunell came to Jacksonville when the franchise was founded from Green Bay. He was backing up Brett Favre, and he was always one of my favorite players, just that scrambling lefty style. And just a funny story is, after the Jaguar days, he was coaching high school football here, and he actually did two lacrosse games with me. He came to the booth, and when we were doing high school lacrosse games at Episcopal High School, and it was fun having him in the booth because he was scouting which guys he wanted to recruit to the football team. So Mark Brunell from the Packers to the Jags is my personal favorite.
Those Jags teams were kryptonite to the Ravens' early teams. Mark Brunell, Fred Taylor was their back,
Jimmy Smith,
and Jimmy Smith were the wideouts, and the Ravens could not beat. I'd have to look it up, but the Ravens, the Jags just had their number.
Fred Taylor and Jimmy Smith in particular put up some huge days against Baltimore. A lot of fun.
And it just made the ultimate insult of back when I was. Were you still in school, Dan, when they announced the NFL expansion and they gave it to Charlotte, and that which became the Panthers? Then they delayed the second city, and then they gave it to Jacksonville. And we're like, really?
They knew you were getting the Browns. That fix was in.
I guess. So. Paul Tagliabue told local sports people that maybe we should build a museum instead in Baltimore. That was crazy.
When I think about like historic NFL trades that have gone the wrong way, there's really two that jump out at me. When the Vikings traded for Herschel Walker.
That's the one I had.
Yeah. And then, so that one was that? Like the late 80s, early 90s?
That was right when Jerry Jones and Jimmy Johnson came together. I watched that Netflix the series on the Cowboys. It was really, really good. I'm not a Cowboys fan, but it reminded me just how freaking good those guys were. And Michael Irvin is a little bit of a head case, but just how good he was and how much of a specimen he is. That began the Cowboys run of those three Super Bowls in 97 in the 90s.
Yeah, so Minnesota traded three first round picks and three second round picks and a sixth and a third for Herschel Walker. Now, Dallas gave something back. Dallas gave two third round picks and a 10th round pick. But man, three first round picks and 3 seconds. That's a franchise wiper. And again, it built the Cowboys dynasty.
Yeah.
And then recently, I mean, the Deshaun Watson trade.
Oh God.
Cleveland.
Was that a trade or was that free agency?
No, that was a trade. So they had Baker Mayfield, and that poor guy is still a really good NFL quarterback and a likable player. He was the face of their franchise on every single commercial that was on TV during that time when he was in Cleveland. Remember those ads where he would be like walking around their stadium and like running to people? And then they let him go. I mean, he had played for four different head coaches in his time there. It was some absurd number of just the turnover. They never built anything around him and just hung that guy out to dry. And then they went and got Deshaun Watson and gave up an insane amount of cap space to sign him. It was a sign and trade deal. So what they gave up, I don't even remember, but it was more of like to acquire him and pay him. And how many games has he played? And what kind of disgrace has he brought to their franchise? And how many victories? They're still digging out from that. It got their coach fired eventually, who I think he's a good coach too. So, man, those are the two ones that jump out at me as like two just awful trades.
Well, not only that, they in the NFL, let's say you sign a 10-year contract for $200 million with a $150 million signing bonus. That's all that the team owes you. I mean, it's a lot of cake, but there's never guaranteed contracts in the NFL like there is in Major League Baseball. So not only did the Browns bring all those things you just described, but then that's what held up Lamar Jackson's last contract negotiations. He wanted all of his money guaranteed. And the Ravens are like, you're out of your mind. Nobody could. In the NFL, they can cut you tomorrow. They don't owe you a penny because they paid you that signing bonus. All of my thoughts center around the Ravens, and it's mostly free agency. First, the bad. Leon Searcy coming off, and they both revolve around when the Ravens won the Super Bowl and then had that window to get back in the early 2000s. They signed Leon Searcy from the Jags, I believe, offensive lineman, and he tore his tricep in training camp, and he never played a down for Baltimore. He just never recovered. And the other gigantic free agent collapse was Elvis Gerbach. Remember Elvis Gerbach came from maybe San Francisco or Kansas City. They got rid of Trent Dilfer, and he was a disaster. He, instead of coming back and competing for the job with other quarterbacks that the Ravens brought in, he just retired. He's like, I'm done.
Well, I think that is more about Baltimore fans than anything. So Trent Dilfer helps lead the Ravens to a world championship. Yet at that time, all Baltimore fans compared every single quarterback to Johnny Unitas. They just did. And it doesn't matter if you won. You just weren't good enough, even though you won a Super Bowl. So we ran Trent Dilfer out of town. We bring in Elvis Gerbach, and he's going to be the guy. You know, he had just been a playoff winning, like an all-pro quarterback for a Pro Bowl quarterback for Kansas City. I don't think he was all-pro, but he went to the Pro Bowl. And then they ran him out of town, too, to the point where he said, I hate Baltimore so much, I am retiring. I am retiring from football rather than play another down for this franchise and for this city. So, again, it wasn't so much – I didn't think it was so much about him as it was just the fan expectations at the time in Baltimore and the comparisons that are on – you can't live up to them.
I would argue that Brian Billick ran Dilfer out of town more than the fans because he won a Super Bowl. So
that's true.
Did they want somebody like Gerbach who could throw for 300 yards? Yes. Elvis Gerbach is just soft. I mean, come on, man. That's soft. That's very soft. Now the good. I think maybe and I might be there's two free agent signings that I love that the Ravens did. One was Anquan Boldin, and he helped Joe Flacco win a Super Bowl, and then Steve Smith coming from the Panthers kind of revitalized his career and played some great football for the Ravens. Didn't win a Super Bowl, but gave us a lot of really memorable moments. So those are some of my free agent successes and failures.
All right, that seems like a good place to stop. Our reminder, the Fly and Dixie podcast is brought to you by Simplicity Group. Simplicity Group is a leading financial products distribution firm that specializes in providing best-in-class insurance, investment, and business development solutions. To learn more, visit simplicitygroup.com. Special thanks to this week's guests, Ray Carncelli and Logan Ipp. Please like us, subscribe wherever you get their podcasts. Tell a friend, share the love. It's free. We love to hear from you. You can email us at dfly.com/Dixie@gmail.com or find us on Twitter and Instagram @dflyanddixie. Thanks for listening, and as always, enjoy the games.